particular topic this morning. It has to do with what do these words mean, which seem to say that we're supposed to be obedient to, and now I've got to worry about what it says we're supposed to be obedient to, as you'll see in a moment when you start looking at the scriptural passages. And even if you could get the words, what do the words mean? As I said yesterday, I am, as far as Greek is concerned, functional illiterate. I don't know any Greek. And although, with the help of my wife's trusty interlinear Greek testament that she gave me, I've sort of gone through these things and tried to get the notion, still what I get are different words in the English language trying to tell me what the Greek meant. And when I got a number of English words, they don't mean the same things. The words power, right, authority, these are different words. They carry different freight with them. Take a simple English word, you know, and you start worrying about what it means. Maybe you don't, I do. Justice Holmes once said that a word is the skin of a living thought. Just gives you sort of an outline, and you've got to fill in the content. The word stock, S-T-O-C-K, you all know what stock means. Cattle is what you buy over the counter when you buy negotiable securities. It's that from which you make soup. It's the supply of goods that a man puts on his shelves. It is at least 48 different things in the American language. And so you plop out a word, and what do you get from it? People have literally died over interpreting this section of Romans 13 we're about to look at now. Authority, right, power. And the church shall receive power, Pentecost. The power of the name of Christ. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln did not like a colonel in the Northern forces, and he put him in prison without a trial. He simply one day sent out and said, put that man in prison. And they put him in prison without a trial. He never did have a trial. And he filed a writ of habeas corpus. Very ancient and honorable writ coming from the Magna Carta that no man can be imprisoned without trial. And the court said, well, of course, you've not had a trial and you can't be imprisoned. And finally got the United States Supreme Court mandating jail all the time. United States Supreme Court said, well, of course, the president can't put you in jail without a trial. And so they ordered the president of the United States to let the man out of trial, and Lincoln's response to that was, whose army are you going to use? Whose army are you going to use? And left him there. The Supreme Court doesn't have any troops, you know. It doesn't have any policemen. And Lincoln said, try it. Now, it's power. The law. Well, that's a terrible thing to say, the law. Some of our medical brethren here today would be, I think they would be grossly offended if I were to say that medicine is those little round tablets that you buy in bottles from the pharmacist. I think that my brethren in the medical profession would say that medicine is the art of diagnosing and prescribing and cutting and stitching and saying nice things and massaging and doing all the rest of the things which collectively does something to a person to make them function better. Medicine, the art, uses various kinds of tools and pharmaceuticals and skills and techniques. And it's an art. It's a way of doing something. It's a way of accomplishing a result. I think that Dale would be most offended if I said that art was the physical piece of canvas with the physical paint on it. I think he would say that art is the bringing out of a certain concept or the transmitting of an idea and so forth. Law is not a rule written in ink on a piece of paper. That's a rule. Law is a process. It's a method, it's an art, it's a way of resolving certain kinds of problems. Government. Do the same thing with it, will you? Well, now, what does the text say? I just picked the first three off of the shelf over there that I come to show you the kind of problem that we're wrestling with here. I don't know whether I can read three books at the same time. Try. This one is Good News for New Life, American Bible Society. This one is King James. This one is, it says, it's Revised American. Let every individual be obedient to the ruling authorities. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority not under God's control. For there is no power but of God. For there is no authority except from God. And under his control, the existing authorities have been constituted. The powers that be are ordained of God. For there is no authority except from God. And those that exist have been instituted by God. And so you can go down through these three versions and you get really sharply different words that are being used. But let's just take one and read it through six or seven verses just to sort of get the thing in context. I'll just take King James because it's in the middle and the print is a little bigger. Okay. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resists the power, resists the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Boy, I can hardly let that one go without getting another version. Therefore, he who resists the authority resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. Very different. Very different. Over here it says, and those who thus resist will incur sentence. Man. For rulers are not, I'm back in King James, for rulers are not a terror to the good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have the praise of the same. That's kind of a lovely thing. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of him who is in authority? Now it's a him, not an it, or the abstract authority, power, that kind of thing. Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant. For your good, don't overlook that little flip on the end of the thing. He is God's servant for a very specific purpose, that is, for your good. This one says, you desire, do you not, to have no reason to fear your ruler? Well, do what is right, and he will commend you. He is God's servant for your benefit. Now, I don't know exactly how to put the inflection in my voice when I read that one. He is God's servant for your benefit. He is God's servant for the limited purpose of benefiting you. In other words, he's not God's servant. And when he comes after to do harm to you, he is no longer God's servant. Or does it say he is God's servant? Hopefully you will be benefited, but he might goof up. Okay. Wherefore, you must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience sake. But if you do wrong, no, then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. He is the servant of God to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer. He is the servant of God to execute his, somebody's, God's, the governor's. Well, it's simple, just what it says here. For he does not bear the sword in vain. He is the servant of God to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer. God's or the policeman's. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. He is God's servant, an avenger to inflict punishment upon the wrongdoer. We must obey, therefore, not only for fear of punishment, but all for conscience sake. And so it continues. Now, what I'm trying to illustrate, and some of you have other versions before you, and I suspect that they are as different in the precise words as the particular one before us. This has been a very difficult problem for the church to wrestle with. As Johann mentioned this morning, the German church had a lot of trouble with this one in the Second World War, when Hitler took the position that, after all, we are the constituted government, the Third Reich, and you must obey the government. For government is instituted of God, and the authority is God's servant, and here we are. And now you do what we say. A couple years ago, during the time that the church had me bouncing around South Africa, I was told precisely the same thing. The government is instituted by God. We are the government. We have made the law. They meant rules. And when you disobey those rules, you are disobeying the authority of the man who is in the government, which is instituted by God, and that's wrong. I'm tempted to say, by God. That's wrong. And, of course, the kings said, divine authority. We are the king, the monarch. We are the rulers by divine authority. For maybe 15 years or longer, I was a hearing officer for the United States Department of Justice, in addition to other duties for which I got paid. That's a voluntary thing. For the purpose of hearing conscientious objectors who claimed the right not to serve in the military government because of religious scruples. And of course, a standard ploy in the hearings that I conducted was to read Romans 13 and say, God instituted the government. The government says that you ought to serve in the military. You claim to be a Christian person, and you have no obligation to do what the government says. Please exegete for me Romans 13. In the early years of that process, most of the cases that I heard were, of course, Jehovah's Witnesses. They, as you probably know, have their own version of Scripture. Perfectly legitimate. Everybody else does. Why shouldn't they? Their version says that they must be subservient to the higher powers, which they happily read as meaning anything that's out of this earth. And then their version goes on to talk about some stop signs and red and green lights and things like that, which are a matter of local ordinances. But in the particular version, as they have written, translated this portion of Romans,
it speaks in terms of authority which one owes to God. As a strictly legal proposition, we say that all rules are subject to be tested. Now, I'm now out of theology for a moment, if that's possible. It isn't possible, but let me play like it is for a moment. We say as lawyers that all legislation by legislative bodies and all decisions of judges are subject to a determination concerning their validity under the Constitution. You know, if it isn't constitutional, then one need not obey, because it isn't really a rule. You know, it's unconstitutional. You can't do that in our form of government. So when the legislature enacts a statute, and I take a look at it and I say, well, that's unconstitutional. Now, nobody has ever said it's unconstitutional yet. And if it comes to a trial, maybe a court will agree with me that it's unconstitutional, and maybe the court will not agree with me. In my case, they usually don't agree with me. But at least that's an open question at first. And so my client says, do I have to do this? And I say to him, it's my opinion as a lawyer. Lawyers like that word, it's my opinion. Because as I tried to explain to you yesterday, who knows until the judge decides? It's my opinion that what the legislature has just done is unconstitutional. It violates due process or equal protection or some other pair of words that I've picked out of the Constitution to test its validity. And therefore, I advise you that you don't have to do it. And you're not violating any law. With all due respect to the legislature, they just didn't have their heads screwed on right when they did this one. And that's not law, because now if the government or whoever else is on the other side feels strongly about it, we may have to go to the court and ask the court to give us a constitutional determination, a determination of constitutional validity. And as you all know, that can change from one level of the court to the next. One first trial court may say, yes, it's constitutional. The Court of Appeals may say, no, it's not constitutional. The Supreme Court of the state may say, yes, it is constitutional. The United States Supreme Court may say something else. Rather recently, one of the justices of the United States Supreme Court said that the determinations of the United States Supreme Court are the last, not because they are right, but they are right because they are the last. Frequently by a 5-4 decision. Now the reason for that, if I can say it in a sentence, was hinted at in our discussion yesterday. Remember that when you are talking about these kinds of questions, you are talking about questions which literally don't have answers. You see, they're only matters of opinion, of judgment, of relative utility, of deciding to play the game that way. And so there isn't any answer that's cast in stone. And I would like to illustrate that as quickly as I can. And I'm about through now with what I want to say to begin with. And maybe we can talk about it then. The state of Washington has for many, many years had a statute dealing with what's called an award in lieu of homestead. A homestead, of course, is where a person claims a piece of property or an exemption on a piece of property. You have it exempt from claims of creditors. It's a way of keeping some land or some other property so that creditors may not take it from you. It gives you a little bit to live on. It's a form of exemption from claims of creditors. A husband and a wife may claim a homestead in property in this state, and if they do not during their life together at the death of one of the spouses, the surviving spouse may claim an award out of the state of the estate of the deceased spouse in lieu of the homestead which could have been claimed during their lifetime. And that amount of property goes to the surviving spouse, free of any other claims and free of other dispositions of the estate and so forth. An award in lieu of homestead. And the statute simply said that where a man and a woman who had lived together in the state of Washington, being married to each other, and one died and no homestead had been claimed, that the survivor might claim an award in lieu of homestead out of the assets of the deceased spouse.
okay on the statute?
One of the first cases that came up to interpret that was involved a man who had been married and his wife had died, and he had an 18-year-old son who had been born mentally handicapped to the point where the son would never be able to take care of himself, that seriously handicapped. The man was in very modest circumstances. He had taken care of this son since his wife's death when the child was very young. And the man had no money. He'd had a tough life. The boy was now 18 years old. The man had only a few dollars, and he was lonely, and he was just sort of struggling along. And he wanted some companionship in his life, and he wrote a letter to the Lonely Hearts Club, really. And he got in touch with a lady back in Iowa who they exchanged photographs and letters, and she agreed to come out and marry him. And she came out to the state of Washington, got off the train at the King Street Station in Seattle. Trains ran then. Sometime around noon, they were married at 1 o'clock. The strain was too much. The man died of a heart attack that afternoon about 4:30. After things calmed down a little bit, the woman realized that she was a surviving spouse, which of course she was, and that no homestead had been claimed during their joint life. Of course, none had. And she claimed an award in lieu of homestead from the estate of the deceased man, which the statute said that she could, and a guardian for the handicapped son appeared in court and said to the court, surely no one would give this woman, a widow of a couple hours marriage, the entire estate, because that's what it amounted to in this instance, and leave this handicapped son without any assets at all. That's inhumane, it's unpalatable, it's unconscionable, it's probably unchristian, it's unsanitary. Your Honor, you can't do that. And the judge said, you know, I'm just a judge, I just keep the law. I just read it and I do what it says. And it says if they were married, if they didn't claim an award, and if one of them died, and if the other one files, that one gets it. I'm sorry. If you don't like the way it comes out, go down to the legislature and ask them to change it. In the meantime, don't ask me to be above the law. I'm just a judge. I just read it. She gets the property. A little while later, a man and woman who'd been living together in the state of Washington got into an argument. He took an axe and sort of split her down the middle. She died. He was tried for murder. He was found guilty of murdering his wife. That's an offense in the state of Washington. And he was sent to prison. He got down to prison, realized that he didn't have any money for cigarettes and candy bars, and then he realized he was a surviving spouse. So he filed a claim for an award in lieu of homestead. He'd been married, his wife was dead, there hadn't been any homestead claim, and he filed. The representative of the wife's estate said, surely, Your Honor, you know. And he said, surely, Your Honor, nonsense. The statute says, married, one dead, no homestead, claim filed, I get it. And the judge says, oh, well, the legislature never meant that. Well, why didn't the legislature mean that? And the words are literally there. But he didn't get any money. The other woman did. Would any of you have voted differently on those two opinions? And is that the way you would have come out? Would you have hung in there as good judges and been true to the law, the statute, the words? Or would you have said, you know, I don't think the legislature meant what they said. Oh, excuse me. I don't think that's what the legislature said. I'm not going to change what the legislature said. I'm just going to read it a little bit, so that it doesn't come out quite the way that you might have read it if you didn't know what was behind it. Now you are into the argument which, if you'll forgive the reference, is splitting the Missouri Senate right down the middle today. You get to read the historical context. You know, do you get to look behind the words and see what motivated the legislature? The Hebrew scholar had a word for this. It appears in the English dictionary called pilpul, P-I-L-P-U-L. a lovely word. It means that you can take a word, you know, like go left, and change it a little bit, and change it a little bit, and change it a little bit, and pretty soon it means that pretty clearly you ought to go right. And you got there just by gradual shifts like that, by reading in context and by saying, well, under the circumstances, a little different. That's what the judge did in the second opinion here. How do you read Scripture? How do you read Romans 13? I would like to suggest to you that this text means that government is an institution created by God. That's true. All institutions are created by God. Everything that is created by God. Nothing exists that wasn't created by God. I would like to suggest to you that anybody in government is a person who is a servant of God. Anybody that's hired by General Electric is a servant of General Electric. Even the man who's stealing money out of the till is an employee, a servant of General Electric. The truck driver who's employed by General Electric and is driving a truck for General Electric and who stops off at the tavern and gets drunk and heads the wrong direction on a one-way street and runs over you is a servant of General Electric. Oh. Someplace now we're going to get comfortable, uncomfortable with that, so uncomfortable that we're going to say that, well, he's on a, quote, a frolic of his own. He's no longer representing the company. If I happen to be representing the person who got run over, I'm going to say, working hours, GE truck, GE man on the payroll. The fact that he's not being a good steward doesn't mean that GE isn't responsible. GE, of course, will argue that he's no longer our servant. He's taken off and doing something of his own. It isn't what we employed him for. We're not responsible for that. At what point in Romans 13 does the government stop being God's servant? Or is it always God's servant? And it's just that pretty soon they are acting negatively to the purpose for which God put them there. You know, you get the repeated stress in all of these versions that the government is there for your good, for your benefit. And as soon as they start acting against your benefit, then it's no longer the government. You know, that's no longer what the servant was called for. Oh boy, are you on dangerous ground. Because this, of course, gets to mean that everybody gets to read the statute for himself. So I walk into the judge and say to the judge, I think it's for the good of this society in which I live that we ignore this rule today, judge, and go the other way. And the judge says, well, that's what the rule says. And I say, well, sure, that's true of most people, but not of me. And I get to read it my way. So judges are constantly torn by this rigidity. You've got to read it the same way for all people at all times. And just because the woman happened to die after 2 hours after the marriage, that's tough, I'm sorry, but you've got to read it in a hard-nosed, strictly literal fashion. And if it comes out tough, why, go to the legislature and talk about it, see if you can get it changed. In the meantime, live with the results. That's the judge on Monday morning. On Tuesday morning, the judge comes in and says, well, surely the people of this state didn't elect me to be a judge just to be kind of like an IBM machine, you know, punch a button and something comes up. They expect me to use my discretion and my sense of equity and justice and to rise above the technical and the literal. And nobody would expect me to give a murderer benefit from the estate of the woman that he had murdered. So I read the words with what they truly meant, not just blah, 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 you know, Dick runs. James runs first grade primer reading. Well, you're on terribly dangerous ground. Unless you're willing to say that when we get together in a governmental form instituted by God and doing what God told us to do, that is to exercise dominion over that government, we elect somebody to be the governor or the judge, and then we say, now we are willing to be bound by that man's determination. The Constitution of most of the states of the United States say that the judge is subject to the law. the law is not subject to the judge. The judge is subject to the law. The president is subject to the law. The law is not subject to the president. And the president doesn't get to change the law. He may be trying awfully hard, in the opinion of some of you, but ultimately the law binds all of us, we say. And yet you get the uneasy feeling, I take it from what we've already said, that there's an awful lot of what we say that goes into what the law is, that interpretation ultimately by the United States Supreme Court of what's constitutional and what isn't. Do we also do that with reference to when government is government? Maybe you have an obligation as a Christian to ultimately decide whether or not that is a legitimate statement of the institution. No question what God created the institution. No question what God meant for us to live in an orderly fashion under law, where we can't live in complete grace. The question is, what's the rest of the content of the word, for example, authority? The authorities. I accused Dale Hayworth this morning of being an authority on art. The man knows an awful lot about art. And if I have a picture and I want to know something about it, I will go to Dale and say, Dale, tell me about this. How is it done? Something about its background. And if he tells me something, I'm going to start with the presumption that he's given it to me the way it is. He is an authority. And authority means someone whose experience and knowledge here is great enough so that it commands my respect. Now, the day that I take to Dale a finely articulated piece of painting, and I'm interested in knowing what size brush the guy got so that it could be magnified on his slides over there by 100 times and still come out with delicate tracery. And I want to know, Dale, how did they do it, you know? And Dale says, I'll tell you, Vern, they put a little paint on a horse's tail and backed it up and went switch, switch, and that's what came out of it. That's where he stops being an authority. I'm sorry, Dale, you've just blown the system. I can't believe it, you see. Is that true of law? Is there a time when what the judge decides so shocks the collective sense of Christianity, love, concern for other people, decency, morality, that you can say, I'm sorry, but you stopped there in commanding respect. You stopped being an authority. That's very, very dangerous. And whatever else Romans says, and then really I am through for the moment, whatever else Romans says, it creates a very heavy presumption in favor of legitimacy of the system. And it doesn't say that you cannot resist. It says when you resist, if you resist, understand what it is that you're resisting. You are resisting an institution which starts out with the seal of good housekeeping. See, that is an institution. It's the format. It's the process that God instituted for man to collectively live together. And it isn't impossible for that thing to go wrong. It's just that you must weigh very, very cautiously and carefully the consequences of denying the validity of the rules or the system, and ought not to go flying off into anarchistic patterns without some very careful consideration of what you're doing. Well, I'm sure that some of you would like to nip at this in one direction or another, and I will try to respond.
That you gave, and I hate to bait the lion in his own den here, but in using your analogy of the woman that, or the man that murdered the wife and benefited from it, I don't know how the Supreme Court of Washington handled that. In Oregon, there's a statute that prevents a person from benefiting through inheritance by the intentional act of murder. You can handle it or as a probate as an equitable proceeding, and therefore without going through a legislative intent. If you handle it equity, you could handle that no person may, as an equal maxim there, of not being able to benefit from your own wrong, coming in equity with clean hands, or probably two or three other these maxims that I can't recall at this time. Mm-hmm. But basically that they, if they're going to use that particular authority or that particular power and get the court to sustain or put their stamp of approval on it, they can only be done within a proper setting. Transforming that over, we can then say that it is God's institution in the equitable sense as well, but it is only God's institution insofar as the duties are being performed in a clean hands sense.
Clean hands here is lawyer talk for the man who comes in and asks the court to do something equitable for me must himself be doing something which is equitable. And you can't be a scoundrel and ask for the court to. You know, the man who comes in having murdered his father and mother and pleads for clemency because he's an orphan. Yeah, that's not clean hands.
The current problem that we struggle with is when we say this is an institution of God, that we then jump to the assumption that therefore everything that happens is correct and right. Rather than that, this is also being managed by those of us who roof every day. And that not everything that is done in that institution or any institution, although the plan of the institution may have been to benefit man, is beneficial.
But we have to start out, you're suggesting that it's possible for a servant of God to act inappropriately.
Well, I did once.
I remember. Okay, you know, that's a possibility. Now, of course, the step immediately beyond that gets you into the problem that Jerry is so beautifully discussing here. How do you manage that? You know, how do you talk about it so that it comes out sounding like you're doing it according to the rules?
Judges have a lot of trouble with this because obviously none of us are going to stand very long for a judge who just sort of announces in advance, I don't care what the legislature said, don't care what Congress said, don't care what the earlier cases said. I'm just going to do this according to what grabs me as being right. You know? We've seen the United States sort of rear up in the last 10 or 15 years and saying the United States Supreme Court is nothing but a bunch of sociologists. They are legislating, you know. They aren't observing the law anymore. They're just doing it the way they think it ought to be done. Who do they think they are? They are also subservient to the law. We want some strict constructionists. And indeed, in the recent appointments to the United States Supreme Court, the president has tried to give us men who are conservative in their interpretation of the rules, you know, where the power to make these determinations, legislation is, rather than men who are, now I've got to search for the word over here. Does the word progressive fit here, who are liberal? I'd like to get a colorless word who means that they read more freely than they read more restrictively. And part of that, ladies and gentlemen, you simply have to see here legislation where we can all get involved and where we can talk to our legislators and tell them what we think about a proposed rule is the best way in the world of getting new rules because we're all involved in it. When the legislature finally announces it, we've had a chance to talk about it, and we've been participants, and we like it, and we'll observe that rule. No way in the world that you can get enough policemen to make us all do something that we don't want to do. So we've got to be involved to where there is an acceptance of these rules as being authoritative. Well, with the acceleration of inventions and pollution and medical discoveries and a million other things in our modern society, it has forced us to change our rules so very, very rapidly. When I first started practicing law, the question of when a person was dead was not a terribly important question.
You know, if you didn't know today, why wait a little while, you find out. With the advent of something like transplants, suddenly the question of when is a person dead, the exact second like this, becomes very important. And I think that everybody knows that death is not an instantaneous thing. You die over a period of days. You know, some functions shut down now, and then later another one, and later the fingernails stop growing, and so forth. You can culture a hamburger out of the butcher shop. Is it dead? What do you mean by that, you see? Well, so we were forced to make a new description of what's death for legal purposes. And we took that to the legislative bodies, and they said, oh, boy. Now, we want to talk to our constituency. The legislature meets once every 2 years in the state of Washington, except for special sessions. And that means that you talk about it, go home, 2 years later you come back, talk about it. We don't have time. The acceleration is much too great. And so people force the issue. I'm guilty of doing this myself. I've taken some nasty questions to the Supreme Court and said, decide now. And they've said, you know, it'd be much better to handle this by legislation. And my answer is, with 18,000 instances of this occurring in the city of Seattle every year alone, we just don't have time to get this through the legislature. Decide. And so the court reluctantly looks around and says, okay, I'll decide that this way, whereupon half of the population goes straight through the ceiling. And the Supreme Court of the United States in the last 15 years or so has offended practically every power block in the United States. You know, they tell the police one thing, they tell us we can't pray in school, they say the legislatures have to redistrict on a one man, one vote. If there's anybody they've missed, it's been sheer accident. See? And so pretty soon people go around putting up signs that say impeach Earl Warren, he's not a judge, he's a political scientist. He isn't doing it according to the law, they mean rules, anymore. He's using his own judgment. And boy, a judge shouldn't use his own judgment. He ought to do it according to the answer. It's in a book someplace. That's unreal. The better process is to work it out by the legislative methodology, where all legislators talk to all constituents, and we're all informed, and we all understand all the issues, and we all make intelligent decisions about everything that there is. I'm out of my mind. There are 3,000 bills dumped on the table every time the legislature of the state of Washington meets. Some of them, which are well-researched and brilliant, like those that I write. Some of them, which are idiotic, like everybody else's. I'm supposed to be an expert on every one of those things. That poor legislator who has to earn his living except for a couple months, which we drag him down there away from his job and underpay him, who is harassed day and night by lobbyists. He's supposed to be an expert on 3,000 topics instantly. You're kidding me. The public is supposed to be educated. You're joking. All that you can do is get a few through, as few as possible, and trust the system to sort of carry on and to use its judgment. But every time you ask a judge to innovate and to do something daring, you're going to be a certain number of people who say, that's not the law. The judge has no police force. We've already established that. You know what Moses had going for him when he wanted the Ten Commandments and the other rules? I don't want to be sacrilegious now. But when Moses got the Ten Commandments, it became very, very important that those things have authority behind them. If Moses had gone into his tent with a sign out front saying, don't disturb me for a few days because I'm going to write the Hebraic code, he would have had precious little support. But boy, when you've got mountains that shake and smoke and lines, it's when somebody steps over it, you drop dead, and when the thunder rolls and you come down with the news straight from headquarters. I don't want to be sacrilegious, but law exists only because there is a feeling of reverence.